I'm going to try to keep this very short and very simple, because eventually I'm going to have to do these talks through a translator. If they're long, it gets really, really long. What we're trying to do is better experience the reality in which we live. Christ says, "Ye have eyes but see not," and that's the way it is. We aren't always aware of what's going on as we're living through life. The way we're going to try to do it is look at the process of the ongoing cosmos, and in doing that, we're going to try to understand the purpose behind it toward the end of the week, and understand the method of how it works so that we can live harmoniously with it and live more efficiently. And in doing that, we're using the Rosicrucian philosophy. The Rosicrucian philosophy is a very excellent philosophy in that it points one's consciousness toward reality in a way that is very much like we experience that reality every day. Now, in this series of talks, all five talks, we're going to focus on something that is in the ongoing process of the evolutionary creation, and that is cycles. Everything in the cosmos is cyclical. The more we know about cycles and work in phase and in harmony with cycles, the easier it is for us to make progress. The word cycle comes from the Greek word, which means circle. The only difference between the Greek and the English is that the Greeks had a strong or a hard C, and what we call cycle, they would call kykle. And that is the way they would call a circle. Now, the Greek mathematicians and the philosophers did a lot of study of circles in abstract. And they saw circles as an excellent symbol for the universal spirit, especially the universal spirit in an unmanifest state. Because a circle is timeless, and it's eternal, and it's perfect. It's static. But that circle, that is the abstract circle, can only be seen with the mind's eye, and even then it is invisible. We, however, are in concrete nature. We're in a world where imperfection dominates and where resistance to perfection dominates. And those are the important and the positive things in this world. The fact that it fights back makes it all the more real. If everything were just the way we wanted it, we'd become complacent and we'd become even more egregiously selfish than we are now. We'd always want to have our way. And that's kind of boring. It's like a daydream, and daydream is always boring. It seems tremendously exciting, but it turns out to be not so. In the concrete, we're subject to time and motion within time. And so we have to talk a little bit about time and cyclical time. Now, cycles seem to spin or seem to turn in time. And that turning in time is, in our language, described by a Latin word, volubus, or volubus. I don't know how they pronounce it. I don't know any Latin, really. And that is the word that is the root for revolution, which means to turn, or evolution, to turn outward, or to turn back in and go, have things go worse is to call devolving. So we're talking about turning in time. Now, the experience of the eternal in manifest as time can be experienced and it can be conceived of in several ways. And it's perfectly all right to think of all of those different conceptions of time simultaneously. In ancient times, society was much more agricultural, and people were dependent on nature, and a knowledge of nature or a sense of what was going on in nature was an extremely important thing. And because all of agriculture is dependent upon the cycles of nature, the cycles of the seasons, the cycle of the day, and things like that, the people were very astute in following time. And they saw time only cyclically. Day follows night, night follows day, year follows year, and the cycles all go like that. It's very reliable, it's something we can depend on, and so their concept of the cosmos was very circular. They saw variations, like you might have a hot spring or a cold spring or something like that, but they saw that all the variations were more accidental and not so much significant. They did not think much in terms of progress at all. Progress is a much more modern concept than from those ancient times. When there were significant events that occurred that were not part of the cycles, they were considered acts of God or something like that, which is a statement we still find in insurance policies, usually it's somewhere down in the small print. In our time, where we're living now, we're aware of circular time. We're aware of the seasons and night and day. We don't pay nearly as much attention to the cycles. We're not sensitive to them. We don't observe them keenly. We're not intent on them. And this is because we have come in the awakening of our selfhood, which we can see is above nature and is capable of directing nature. We think that we are in all ways beyond nature. Now, we, to some extent, that is true. But we can't do without nature at this point. So we're pretty conceited beings. And in our conceit, we tend to find circles or cyclical thinking, we consider that boring. We consider it way too repetitive. And we think those kinds of things are beneath us. In fact, if we think about cyclical day-to-day living, we call that the daily grind. Or we say that we're on a treadmill. We're going in circles and we're not getting anywhere. And we think of advancing ourselves. We think of progress. And we think of getting somewhere, even if that somewhere is just something different from where we are now. So consequently, we look at time as a linear thing. In fact, we even say when we're speaking of someone in a derogatory sense, we call them non-linear, meaning to say that they are insane because they don't think in terms of a straight line. It fits into society. In ancient China, it was taught that they always built the entryways to their houses in curves because they thought that the devil walked a straight line and that if they had a curved entryway, the devil couldn't get in. It's just the opposite now. We say, are you a straight shooter? And we say that somebody who isn't a straight shooter, we call them crooked. So times have changed very much. We look at progressing through history, especially in our reporting of it. If you go listen to the newscasts or something like that, we look at it like we're following a superhighway that we pass from the past through the present into the future, and the faster you can go, the better it is. Some of the cycles we consider almost inconveniences. And we say that somebody's spinning their wheels. Or we say that somebody's going in circles. So for many of the activities on Earth, both biological and human affairs, it's all right to look at both the cyclical view of time and the linear view of time. They're both workable. And if you take each one of them, it has its strengths and it has its weaknesses. The circular concept of time allows us to see something again and again and again, and it allows a lesson to sink in. And it's very comforting. It's very comforting to know that winter isn't going to last forever, and that, you know, eventually it's going to get warm. The only place that you have perpetual springtime is in Minneapolis, right? But the circular view is not really progressive. And progress is something important. Linearity is in some ways discomforting, but you do get somewhere. However, if you try to get somewhere too fast or try to be too linear, your straight line progress becomes tangential. And it's not like you have that close circular intimacy with nature, and you go off on a tangent of doing your own thing. And our modern society, scientific society, has gone on quite a few tangents that have been not at all good. Now, most of us, most of the time, accept both things simultaneously. We look at day to day and we realize that the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning and all of those things, but yet at the same time, we hope that we're going to be a little bit better tomorrow than we were today. And that's a really healthy thing. Now, in the Rosicrucian philosophy, it teaches not only that circular and linear time are compatible with each other, but if the two of them are combined, they are much more descriptive of the true nature of reality. And that is, everything that is worked out in nature is a spiral. There are spirals of growth, there are spirals of energy in the way galaxies open and close. So everything is spiral. And in the evolutionary creation, the features of both the cycle and the straight line are helpful. With the cyclicity, we again learn things repetitively until we get it. And each time we see it from, because there's an incremental progress in a linear way, the conditions are never quite the same as they were before. And each time you come around the cycle, it's a little different, and you can appreciate it more than you could the last time you were in that phase of the cycle. So the linearity is not as exaggerated as we in our human conceit would like to picture it as being. It's a much more slow thing. Rod gave an excellent talk this afternoon, and one of the things that was in that talk, though he didn't say it outright, was that progress and growth is very, very slow. You do the exercises all of your life, and you give it everything you've got, and maybe after 20, 30, 40 years, you see a little bit of progress. You find yourself not doing things that you didn't do before. And if you're self-observant, as all of those exercises Rod was talking about, you can recognize what of it is just part of a normal maturation process, or what of it is a matter of your own effort that you've moved yourself forward. So we are going to look at cycles, but cycles as part of a cyclic, part of a spiral kind of way of looking at life, because that seems to be what the nature of reality is. Now, there are other ways of conceiving time than circular or linear or spiral, but they're too far afield. Mystics look at time in a much, much different way, and maybe sometime we'll have a chance to look at that. Now, there are differences between the perfect abstract mathematical cycle or circle and the manifest cycle. Every point in the mathematical circle is identical to every other point, and every point is interchangeable with every other point. The mathematical circle is very democratic. It has no beginning, it has no end, and it's very hard to differentiate one. You have to do it arbitrarily. You say, well, we'll start here. There are conventions about where the starting of a circle is in angular rotation and such like that, but those are only conventions. For this reason, as we said a little earlier, the mathematical circle is the symbol of the universal spirit. There is a classical notation that was given by Pascal, and much earlier it was given by St. Augustine, who didn't have a mind for mathematics and didn't have a mind for much of anything but dogma. But I think it probably goes back to the Orphics. Everything that's really good does go back to the Orphics. And the notion there was that a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. That was the mathematical definition of the universal spirit. Now, it's very different with manifest cycles and experienced rhythms, because they're organized in such a way that there are starts. You know, when it melts in spring, that's the start of the annual cycle. That's really a start of your growing season. And that's a natural kind of a start. And so that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. We're going to try and examine in the first three talks a cycle that has been studied by all mystery schools of all ages, and probably all religions have looked at it. And we're only going to look at it in terms of thirds, but it's a beautiful cycle that could be broken down into quarters, or it could be broken into halves, and each way would give a good insight. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, this cycle is called the life cycle. In other philosophies, usually in the Orient, it's called the wheel of rebirth. That is, from rebirth to rebirth. Now, even though the life cycle is a manifest cycle, there are several phases, and there are several places that we could use as beginning points. What we're going to do is we're going to try and follow the suggestion of the poet William Blake, talking about mystical endeavor and spiritual accomplishment. He has a beautiful one-sentence poem. To be a star, you must shine where you are. Beautiful thing. You know, it almost sounds like Ogden Nash, only much more profound and not all the nonsense. So to be a star, you must shine where you are. So we're going to begin looking at this cycle in this moment, where we are right now. To use the technical terms of the Rosicrucian philosophy, you could say where we are right now is that we are focused in our dense physical bodies, in the chemical region of the physical world. Technical things are always long. They turn out to be a shorthand, but they're always long. Now, some people, quite a few people, believe that this is all there is. There's nothing more than this. For them, there is no cycle. For them, it's a straight line. For them, you know, maybe after 24 or something like that, it's a straight line down to death. There's not, there'll be progress, it just means the progress is how quickly you get to the end of it or not. They see cycles, like the cycle of the seasons, they just see those as accidental circumstances from astronomical conditions, and they can tell you via Newton's laws why they're cyclical as they are. And that's enough for them, I guess. That's one of the consequences of linear materialism, is you have to be content with what you get. If you see the world as a bowl of stones, that's what your dinner is. Boy, I can take good cheap shots at them, can't I? So let's begin with looking at the cycle very broadly. And we won't even add much detail tonight. And the way we're going to do this is not going to be really descriptive. In order to be descriptive about the life cycle, I would have to be a full-blown seer, being able to see all the way to third heaven and be able to describe what is along the way. Well, describing what's along the way, you know, it's sort of like a commentator announcing a baseball game. It's better than nothing, but it's certainly not the same thing as being at the game itself. And I'm not really keen about those kinds of descriptions. So we're going to talk about what goes on, but we're going to talk about what goes on in terms of trying to see the principles underneath, because if we understand the principles, we can apply them to our own living. Suppose we look at somebody who's new to being focused in the dense physical body in the chemical region of the material world, an infant. And what we see is that infant is not very well focused in this world at all. The materialist would say that's because not enough of the brain and nervous system has developed and muscles haven't been developed, and that would be their explanation for it. Mystics claim it's because more of the constitution of that spiritual being that is going to grow up to perhaps be a profound jurist or something like that is still not focused here yet. If we look at an infant, that it's uncomfortable in its body and it can't do much here. So it spends a lot of its life in sleep, and it sleeps as much as possible. Most of its consciousness, the seers tell us, is focused in the spiritual world. And there's a lot of evidence of that. When you watch very little children, they're focused on things that aren't here in this world, and it isn't a matter that the eyes aren't developed. But it is true that the senses aren't developed. An infant will try to reach for an object all the way across the room until it learns about distance and how things are in this world. The body of an infant is whole. It's beautifully whole. You look at those little fingers, they're capable of articulation. You look at the ear of an infant and you can almost look through it. It's so translucent. So it's whole, but it isn't finished. It's undeveloped. And if we look at that body, it's soft. Very soft. Some of the bones are almost rubbery, and parts of the skull aren't even closed yet. Above all, it has needs. It is more of a receiver for the fulfillment of its needs than it is someone who gives. It needs food. It needs to be touched. And it reaches out to its parents, and the parents who in other things might be somewhat callous can't help but to love the infant. Max Heindel likes to say it's a bundle of love and joy straight from heaven that we can't help but to love. And what happens is that the loving parents try to do everything that the child needs. Unfortunately, in their materialism, that means giving the child things rather than giving the child all the touching and all of the things of that kind that it really needs. They help the child. They have the understanding of progress, which that infant cannot yet see for itself. The infant doesn't have its own desire body awake until it's a teenager. And so there are macrocosmic desires, but the first desires are the desires that come from the parents. They help the baby to become upright. They help the baby to become mobile. And they help the baby to communicate what it needs, and to be able to share their love with that baby. They instill motivation, and they do it with positive reinforcement. I can remember taking my first step, and it was one of the most wonderful moments of my life. We had unusual kitchen chairs of a style that you don't see anymore. There were not only spokes on the back of the chair, but there were spokes that cantilevered back out to a little tab that went out to the back of the chair. And I can remember hanging onto that chair, which was sort of a yellow cream-like color, and I took my first step, and it was wonderful. Not the taking of the step, but all of the positive reinforcement. I don't think I've ever received such positive reinforcement that was really well meant and that was given in a way that was completely unselfish and there was no gloss to it at all. And then that's why that moment has stuck with me through my entire life. But at any rate, gradually a child develops and it passes through all kinds of stages, which are recapitulations of even grander cycles, but we won't be going into that now. There's variation. Variation from individual to individual, but pretty much it's the same for all children. By understanding the different stages of development, especially if you can understand them relative to past stages of evolutionary development, and if you can see how each child idiosyncratically goes through those stages of development, you can do wonderful things in education and helping the child to develop. That's a subject that's way, way too big to talk about, and I'm not sure that I'm the one that's completely qualified to talk about that. At any rate, it is a recapitulation of our whole journey in the evolutionary creation. Now, in our past and in this life, we are subject to more and more different kinds of influences, more and more different kinds of states of being, and they have all been brought to us cyclically. They can be represented in astrological terms, and we will do a very little bit of that toward the end of the week. But at any rate, there is a cycle of growth and development that has its stages, just like the stages of the cycle of the moon that we're talking about in the other series of talks. Now, all of this understanding and living through all of this requires a good deal of effort and a good deal of work. But every bit of effort that we put into understanding all of this and applying it is really quite wonderful. And it even determines what kinds of beings we're going to come out to be. We have a tremendous advantage if we self-consciously know what is going on, and we can self-consciously participate in that going on. Now, the only reason we mention things like cyclicity and education or developmental cycles is so that perhaps one of you will get interested in it and will embark on a study on your own and bring back things to me that I can't possibly get to. So gradually, the developing child passes away from the motivation that comes from the parents, and it even comes to pass through the macrocosmic motivation. After the parent instilled motivation, the desire body of the child is still in the macrocosmic desire bodies, and there are certain things that are in those desire bodies that all children like and go through. Mark has pointed out to me that there is a certain age that in all children there is an extreme fascination for dinosaurs. And this is not only in our culture, it's all over. You see, I go to South America and I see kids there interested in dinosaurs at a certain age. Certain ways of playing are common to all children at certain ages. However, at puberty, the macrocosmic desires are left and the person begins to be born into personal, self-motivated desire. The desire body was there in the infant, but it isn't really unfolded until it is born in that time of puberty, when all kinds of desires, not just sexual desires, but all kinds of other desires come out. Take a teenager and you have somebody that is a romantic that feels things as well as almost any romantic poet. Now, there are many other kinds of development that are going on simultaneously with the development of motivation, but we have been intentionally focusing on motivation for a particular reason, because there's something about desire that is really important, and that has to do with two concurrent kinds of factors in the life cycle. The first of those has to do with progress and lines of progress or looking at progress. All cycles have at least one direction of flow, and usually certainly two. It's possible to have more if you look at them in interdimensionality, but there are different directions. In us, and in our evolutionary creation, advancement is accomplished through motivation. And motivation is part of the desire factor, or the part of the desire function of our being. Desire motivates us to take action. And we can't get anywhere unless we take action. Desire is actually what separates the humans and the animal kingdom from the plants and minerals. The plants and minerals are fixed. They're rooted. Plants have vital life, but they can't get anywhere. Desire motivates animals and humans to move. So, desire is object-oriented. We desire to move towards something or away from something. Desire, in this sense, is not vague and diffuse. It is something that is very specific. We desire things. We desire objects. And this desire of things propels us forward in life. We look forward to new objects and objectives. Our first objective in life was the love of our parents. But that was because they loved us. It's very much like Paul's statement. We love him because he loved us first. And because our parents love us, we respond. We flow back to them. And as we said just a minute ago, we are motivated to take those steps. And eventually we're motivated to play with our friends. But when individual motivation takes hold, then the desire function is intensified. And it is ramified according to our past history with desire. We want more. You know how it is. I want the car. I want to be able to drive. That's probably the big one in our culture. Because that means that we can take our desire beyond personal locomotion and we can really get somewhere if we have a car. And so it pushes us forward. The important point in all of that is that it moves us in that forward direction. One might say that we revolve forward in time. We make traction, which is a word that some young people like to use. There's no traction in that kind of life, or they say, I want traction. And the result of the forward motion and the desire behind that forward motion is materialization. And a big part of that materialization is deeper incarnation. It always, or almost always, drives us deeper into the world. When we want something, it takes us more and more in the world. There are corollaries to that, because if we attain our desires, then we have responsibility. So that's a big part of it. In folklore, we even have statements like, our possessions own us, and we don't own our possessions. But the people that have our high desire people eventually have to become very responsible people, because they have to take care of those things, even if only just to protect them. So, the more we desire in life, the more we become incarnated. If and when we become sexually active with that most powerful desire, the desire to create or to procreate, no matter how we may see that artificially, all of this is greatly magnified. This is why pulling oneself out of sexual attachment is such a painful thing. So when we have the intense desires, we grow up quickly. Ask any youth who have, you know, they have children at 13 or 14 years old. They grow up in a big hurry. They become like adults very quickly because there are responsibilities. Our causes have consequences. And so one of the consequences of exercising the desire of sexuality is having babies. And if there's anything that is a responsibility, it is a baby. This is looking at the baby as a responsibility, not as an opportunity to love the way we did just a few minutes ago. Now, we have to note here that when we're talking about desire, we're talking about desire in general. We're not talking about a specific kind of desire, and we're not saying that one desire is a good desire or a bad desire or anything like that, but we're just talking about desire per se. Now, we can see then that the first of these two factors with desire is something that propels us forward in the life cycle. And you might say it screws us or winds us deeper and deeper into material responsibility. And if you want to be earthbound, all you have to do is desire. And when you desire a lot and you desire very deeply, that's going to be the result of it. Now, the second factor in all of this is corollary to the first. Max Heindel states it in several places in the Cosmoconception, and it is repeated often. This is one of the most profound statements you'd ever want to hear, and it goes against everything we tend to think of right now. And that statement is, right now, at this stage of evolution, all consciousness is the result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body. All consciousness is the result of the struggle between the vital body and the desire body, which is to say that all of our consciousness is a consequence of the struggle between the vegetative principle and the motivative principle. The vegetative principle would have things endure forever and live like a plant that would have no motivation. The motivational principle would have us live by desire and break down the body as quickly as possible. It doesn't care about the body. It just wants that experience of desire. And between these two forces, in their reflection in the human spirit and in the life spirit, is where the waking up of consciousness takes place. Said another way, the consciousness of self relative to the consciousness of selfness out of which our self-consciousness came, that interplay between the two of them is completely dependent at this point in our evolution to how we deal with the interaction between the vegetative principle and the desire principle. Now that's really, really very heavy statement itself. And it's been this way for quite a while. Max Heindel tells us that in this long-term evolutionary struggle, the result of following the desire principle produces hardening. And the result of focusing on the vegetative principle produces softening. He states that in principles, when desire has been extremely strong is when we precipitated the hard, bony skeleton that we have now. And that is, we wanted leverage. And that desire for leverage, which is a big advantage if you're living on the surface of the earth, that is a consequence of that desire. It came about as a result of that. So, the life cycle and what it does is no exception to this general rule. So we can see that at the same time that we are impelled forward in life by desire, we are winding deeper into matter and responsibility, and our vehicles are hardening. all of our vehicles, even our physical vehicle. The more we desire, the harder our vehicles become. We can see that if we look at the body of a physical body of a baby, it's soft and rubbery. Then you look at the body of somebody who's old. They're crusty. They're brittle. And this applies to all of our other vehicles at the same time. Someone who desires much has a very clearly defined character because they harden the desire nature in such a way that it is inflexible. If you want one thing, you gear yourself to that one thing. You even build muscles, which are a physical reflection of desire nature. You build the muscles you need to get to that. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have concert pianists. It takes a desire to build the kind of muscles to play the music that we need. If somebody's psychologically hard, it is because of indulging themselves in desires and wanting to do so. Max Heindel tells us that some people produce desire bodies which are so rare we can't even take a photograph of them with the Carillion. They produce desire bodies that are so hard that even after a person has left in death, those desire bodies hang around for thousands of years. Thousands of years. You've got part of your nature tied up like that because it's so hardened that even the normal purgatorial existence doesn't break it down. Now, everything we have said is something that is evident in the few examples we've given, but if you do much more observation, you'll see that it's evident in all kinds of things in life. So if we ask ourselves, do these two factors in the life cycle give a complete picture of the life cycle, even in the most rough and general sense? The answer is obviously no. That describes one factor. It describes one part of evolution. If we observe old people, we see that they are not usually psychologically petrified, at least not all of them. Some of us are. And they're not all flinty characters. In general, most older people are more thoughtful. And they're more understanding. And it's almost like they've been softened by life. About just a little over a month ago, I went to my 50th high school class reunion. And from the moment I walked in the door, I was impressed because everybody had been softened. It wasn't like when they were young and still ambitious. Those reunions were tough to go to. In this case, they were softer, kinder, more loving people. And you could see that life had worn them down almost the way erosion wears a mountain down. It can't remain that way. And it was quite obvious. So we have to ask ourselves another question. Why is this? Is there another major factor in the life cycle rather than the desire principle motivating us forward? And the Rosicrucian philosophy implies that there is at least one more factor. There may be more. We're only going to talk about one. So let's return to something that we mentioned just a few minutes ago. It was said a few minutes ago that sexual union is a really hardening factor, and it closes a lot of inner doors to perception that someone has that is prepubescent. They can see things even with the psychological vision without clairvoyance, that once you become sexual, that they're gone forever. It isn't an accident that in the ancient mysteries that there were certain things that could only be done by people who were virgin. and the responsibilities of raising a child are extremely incarnating. However, if we look at that, either in our own experience or in our friend's experience, there's something compensatory. There's something else that's taking place that's quite obvious. Everything in the evolutionary creation is complemented. Everything is balanced, and that is wonderful. For everything being one way, there's something going another way to balance it out, and both are good. What happens is that when one raises children, one begins to look back. The same things that were in our childhood that we have all forgotten, we can see in our children. And we begin to ponder how we came to be what we are. And there is an awful lot of watching that goes on in this process. If we are insightful when we're watching our children, we can see how certain behaviors are the results of what we did in our own childhood. We can see things that led to what we are now. It's a very fulfilling thing to know how you got to be what you are. If we're extremely observant and insightful people, and we do a lot of philosophical pondering as well, we can see that there is a basic archetype to character. A basic archetype to the personal being that has been there all of the life. My mother she didn't know anything about mysticism until very late in life. She didn't know anything about it. She said, there are some things you try so hard to form the person and you can't. There are some things that are just that person and they are uniquely that way all the way from the earliest time on. But my mother always used to say, you're the same Richie that I knew when you were a little boy. It is that the things that I did as a child, that basic stamp, that archetypal character that I am in manifestation in this life, she could see that in childhood and she could see it in adulthood, so that in some way she wasn't interested in what that character was working on, what it was being applied to, what kind, you know, like I'd come home and say, I'm interested in this and this and this and this kind of creative activity, and she'd say, yes, you're the same as you've always been. And you say, no, look at, I'm interested in this, and she was right. At least as far as that is concerned, she was right, because she could see that it was there. However, after mysticism came along, she shook her head and she said, you're the same and yet you're not the same. She could see that there was indeed a second birth. And she could see that there was something different that had taken place. So we have all remembered things. And I have a hard time with vision here. We've all had experiences where we've done things we don't like, where we've hurt others. And in these remembrances, we feel their hurt. Remembrances such as these, when you look at it from the other person's point of view and say, oh my God, I had to do something maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I went to a different class reunion. And I used to, not seriously, but I used to molest a woman in high school. I'd rub up against her, whether she liked it or not, and I'm sure she thought it was repulsive. And I went to the reunion, and I took one look at her, and I said, oh my God. And I couldn't do it then because she was afraid of me. And so I wrote her a letter. And I said, I am tremendously sorry. It must have felt awful. She never responded, but in the desire world, I sure felt it like, wow, she couldn't believe that that somebody would go back to. What happens is, what I'm trying to say is, when you think about the experience and remember the experience from the other person's point of view, you become a kinder person. You become the kind of person that everybody wants to be. And so this is a process of refeeling. And not only does it soften one, and not only does it unbind what we have bound up in those kinds of desires, it gives us an even better insight into the nature of reality. In fact, it gives us clearer views going the other direction of what kinds of motivation are positive motivations and which are not. So, we can see that simultaneously there are two different activities in our consciousness that drive this cycle and that redeem this cycle. One is forward-looking, which takes us more and more into matter, and the other is backward-looking, which lifts us more and more out of matter. And that's common to everyone in the entire life cycle. It's really wonderful. This is happening to everybody, whether they realize it or not. We're all growing up. We're all becoming better people, only we are extremely fortunate because we can see the process and we know what's going on. And boy, if you don't fight against it and if you work with it, it's a much more efficient way of living and it's a much more joyful kind of life. So, there are two types of events that intensify the activity, the second activity. And we've already mentioned one. That is births. When we have children that are born and we watch those children, that is extremely important to us. As equally as important are the births of grandchildren. Because with the births of grandchildren, you're watching and you can see that the process goes on wave after wave after wave. And that's a special kind of looking back. It isn't just looking back at me and my kids. It's you can see that it comes more. And on top of that, when there are grandchildren, you watch your children watch their children. And this gives you a removed vantage. Grandparents can do things with the grandchildren that they never would have done with their own children because they don't have that heavy responsibility and they can relax and they can love and do things that they would like to do that they don't have to worry about whether the kids are going to grow up to be good kids and all of that. And so this removed vantage gives a very relaxed outlook. But even more than that, when you watch somebody else watch, you're seeing the process of consciousness through the memory observation. You're seeing that process and what the consequence of it is and how it's taking place. And that collapses. And that collapses into your own consciousness. So by watching your children watch their children, it leads to the kind of consciousness that you watch yourself watching. And that is the basis of almost all forms of transcendental meditation. When you transcend the participation in the concrete world and you watch your own activity in precipitating into that concrete world, that is when one wakes up to the thinker rather than to the thoughts. That is when one wakes up to the spiritual activator instead of just the actions. So the birth is the birth is one of the two kinds of activities that change the emphasis of the whole cycle. The other is death. When I've looked back in memories recently, and I had one about a year and a half ago that was really a humbling, humiliating thing. The absurd egoism that we have is really quite something. I was remembering an event from childhood. And as I was remembering it, I was watching myself remember. And I said, oh my God, I'm the only person in this memory that is still alive. And then my absurd thought was, I can't die. Because if I die, this is lost. Which is utterly silly, because, and then when you think about it, you say, oh, you know, like all of our petty little lies, for the wonderful lessons that we learn in them, they're eternal, but they aren't the end of all things. We're all going to die, and in the bigger outlook of things, it's something much more wonderful than that. And so there's something about death that is the ultimate releaser from the hardening. When they say a person dies of natural causes, they would probably better be saying that a person dies from hardening. You just limit, you know, like I try to read physiology, and I was just reading cell physiology last night, and I read something, no, I was on the internet this morning, that we don't become less creative as we get old. It's just that the body has less options. We limit ourselves, and we have less and less options, and that's when the hardening is closing in on us. The death that is probably most important is the death of parents. Because when the parents die, the people from our earliest infancy who were the first people to shepherd us forward in life, that were the object of our going forward, they're no longer there. And then we're left in such a place that we have nothing to look forward to but death. And this greatly magnifies the looking back. But it also brings upon us an incumbency to be responsible. People who have known me, my father died just about 3¾ years ago. And since then, I've become much more of a no-nonsense person. People who are prove themselves to be incorrigible, I accept that fact. I don't give up on the fact that that they can be redeemed, but I recognize that their relationship with me, maybe because of their part, because of my part, there is no redemption possible. And if things become obnoxious, you know, it's like Oliver Wendell Holmes says, you weep not for those who bear the cross, but for those who bear the cross without the glory. And for some people, you get into interactions with them that you're only bearing the cross and there's no possible glory. And I have dismissed several people from my life. I don't interact with them anymore because there's nothing that can be done. I've become more no nonsense. I'm pretty namby pamby yet, but for me, that's a big step forward. So we can see that there is increasingly, it's like running a different kind of race. Not a running a race toward death, not running a race toward winning the prize, but it's running a race of looking back and seeing how much you can see, how much you can derive out of the wonder that we call a life. And that's as far as we're going to go tonight, and we'll talk about another third of the cycle tomorrow, which is very different than this one. We'll close with the Rosicrucian prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.